I started yesterday's talk with a quote from William Morris. I'm going to start today's talk by another quote from William Morris, a shorter one. Love and work, these two things only. Love and work, these two things only. So Morris was passionate about work. But bringing love and work together is not easy. However, people can find ways, even in the most difficult of circumstances. In the 1970s, I read a book written by a Hungarian called Miklos Harasti. The book was called A Worker in a Worker's State. In those days, a worker's state was used to describe East Germany, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, countries that were satellite states of the Soviet Union. And in the book, Harasti, who was a dissident writer and poet, describes life as a worker in the Red Star tractor factory in communist Hungary. Now, it was a communist state, but in fact, the management methods in the factory closely resembled conditions in Western factories with detailed supervision, very little autonomy for the workers, and with individual pay tightly linked to the amount produced by each worker. And in the absence of truly free and independent trade unions, the scope for resisting the system of production was very limited. But Harasti describes how the workers nevertheless found a way to rebel and to assert their independence by making what he calls homers. When the factory supervisors were not watching, the worker would surreptitiously look around for some leftover junk pieces of metal. And then he would explore the available unused machines near to his workstation and decide what he would like to make. Harasti says he didn't necessarily set out to make something useful, and he definitely didn't set out to make something to sell. Harasti called these two steps, producing something useless and renouncing payment, two steps towards the senseless and two steps in the direction of freedom. The worker temporarily at least won back power over the machinery, subordinating his skill to a sense of beauty. And Harasti comments that however insignificant the object was, its form of creation was artistic. The beauty of the homer came first and foremost from the labour itself. He wrote, "The tiny gaps which the factory allows us become natural islands where, like free men, we can mine hidden riches, gather fruits, and pick up treasures at our feet. We transform what we find with a disinterested pleasure, free from the compulsion to make a living. It brings us intense joy, enough to let us forget the constant race, the joy of autonomous, uncontrolled activity, the joy of labour without rate fixers, inspectors, and foremen." For writing the book, Harasti was brought to trial by the communist authorities and given a suspended jail sentence. The manuscript was suppressed, but it was later published in the West in the book, A Worker in a Worker's State. Harasti's words inspires a vision of work as a central part of a fulfilling life. I personally have been very lucky in my life in finding emotionally rewarding and fulfilling jobs. But for the vast majority of people, work is a means to an end, a necessary affliction to earn money if they can get work. A recent worldwide survey covering 142 countries investigated how many employees were psychologically fully committed to their jobs, how many were lacking in motivation, and how many were actively disengaged, that is, were fundamentally unhappy with their work. And the survey's results show that a quarter of all the workers in the world today are actively disengaged. That means a quarter of all the workers in the world today are fundamentally unhappy with their work. And two-thirds of all workers around the world are lacking in motivation. They're not motivated at work. And only one in eight workers are lucky enough to be psychologically fully committed to their job. On top of that, we live in a world where over 200 million people are unemployed, 75 million of whom are young people aged between 15 and 24 years. And in some countries, a quarter of young people are neither employed nor in some form of education or training. In the UK, it's a fifth of all young people are neither employed nor in some form of education or training. So work and the lack of work are major sources of suffering in our world. How did we get to this situation and what can we do to change it? When you look back historically, what you see is that Judeo-Christian tradition has played an important part in attitudes to work. The Garden of Eden was a place of abundance where everything was provided for Adam and Eve. But because they chose to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, God tells Adam, "Because you have listened to your wife and have eaten from the tree which I forbade you, accursed shall be the ground on your account. With labor you shall win your food from it all the days of your life. You shall gain your bread by the sweat of your brow until you return to the ground." And it's true that for much of recorded history and for most of humankind, life has involved drudgery and hard physical work. Work was something unpleasant and had to be endured as an unquestioned part of the socioeconomic structure of society. But then, with the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, came a bit of a changed perspective on work, which would eventually help to pave way for the Industrial Revolution and the emergence of capitalism. This is highlighted in a book called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism by a German economic sociologist, Max Weber, which was published early in the 20th century. The Protestant work ethic involves diligence, punctuality, deferment of gratification, and the primacy of work. But some elements of the Protestant work ethic did not fit well with the coming industrial age, because one of the central aspects of the work ethic was that an individual could be the master of their own fate through hard work. And within the context of a world dominated by agricultural and by craft production, this was to some extent true. But accompanying the industrial age came the start of a radical process of the de-skilling of work with the introduction of machine manufacture and the detailed division of labour. People were forced off the land with the enclosure movement. Home-based crafts were destroyed as production shifted from the countryside to the factories in the towns and cities. And in this way, knowledge of the overall process of work was monopolised by the owner of the means of production. And the shift to a new culture of work was accelerated in the 19th and early 20th century by two developments. First of all, the assembly line of mass productions with its machines, where tasks were broken down into smaller and smaller parts in a more and more detailed division of labour. And second, with scientific management, of which a man called Frederick Winslow Taylor was the great proponent. Taylor brought time study analysis into the picture, and the human being was harnessed to the assembly line to become part of the machine. And de-skilling and the spread of the division of labour continued apace throughout the 20th century, spreading into more and more areas of work with efficiency, productivity and speed up as the watchwords of production. Nowadays, if you call your bank, this often involves speaking to someone who could be located in a call centre anywhere in the world, who greets you and responds to you with predetermined set phrases, whose knowledge and initiative is strictly limited by the employer, and whose productivity is measured by the number of transactions carried out in a limited period of time. All calls are recorded and the efficiency of operators assessed hour by hour. The methods of the factory are now reproduced in human conversations. Unless we believe that industrial factory conditions could not return to those of the 19th century, we should note the horrible conditions of the sweatshops in Bangladesh and the reports from mainland China of the terrible lives of the 500,000 workers at the Shenzhen and Chengdu factories owned by Foxconn. Foxconn are a Taiwanese-based company, and they produce millions of Apple and other computer products each year. In these Foxconn factories, conditions were so bad that after a spate of suicides in 2010, workers were asked to sign a statement promising not to kill themselves and pledging to treasure their lives. So problems such as those at Shenzhen and Chengdu will not go away as long as we are stuck with a fundamental approach to work of modern capitalism and modern economics. You may be familiar, some of you, with a wonderful book published in the 1960s by E.F. Schumacher called Small is Beautiful. And in the book, there's a groundbreaking essay called Buddhist Economics. And in that, Schumacher describes what he says is the modern economist's take on labour and work. This is what he says. The modern economist has been brought up to consider labour or work as little more than a necessary evil. From the point of view of the employer, it is in any case simply an item of cost to be reduced to a minimum if it cannot be eliminated altogether, say by automation. From the point of view of the workman, it is a disutility. To work is to make a sacrifice of one's leisure and comfort, and wages are a kind of compensation for the sacrifice. Hence, the ideal from the point of view of the employer is to have output without employees, and the ideal from the point of view of the employee is to have income without employment. In this way, a vision of fulfilling work as an end in itself is lost, and the battle lines between employer and employee are drawn up within a very limited perspective on the role of work. How does this compare with the Buddhist attitude to work? The Buddha lived 2,500 years ago in a predominantly agricultural society, but he had great knowledge of the many trade and craft specialisms that were around at the time. He had detailed awareness of the processes of agricultural work and of the crafts, and he often used similes drawn from them to illustrate a point he wished to emphasize when giving a teaching. For example, in the Satipatthana Sutta, when teaching how to follow the breath, the Buddha adds, "Just as a skilled turner or his apprentice, when making a long turn, discerns, 'I am making a long turn,' or when making a short turn, discerns, 'I am making a short turn,' in the same way, the monk, when breathing in long, discerns, 'I am breathing in long,' or breathing out long, he discerns, 'I am breathing out long.'" And once, when waiting for his alms food, the Buddha was challenged by a Brahmin farmer. The farmer saw him and sneered, "I plough and sow, and having ploughed and sown, I eat. You should also plough and sow, and having ploughed and sown, you will eat." The Buddha replied, "Brahmin, I too plough and sow, and having ploughed and sown, I eat. When the puzzled Brahmin said, "You claim that you plough and sow, but I do not see you ploughing," the Buddha replied, "I sow faith as the seeds. My discipline is the rain. My wisdom is my yoke and plough. My modesty is the plough head. The mind is the rope. Mindfulness is the ploughshare and the goad. I am restrained in deeds, words, and food. I do my weeding with truthfulness. The bliss I get is my freedom from suffering. With perseverance, I bear my yoke until I come to nirvana. Thus I have done my ploughing. It brings the fruit of immortality. By ploughing like this, one escapes all suffering." But the Buddha also gave very specific directions on work to his lay followers. And what he called right livelihood is an important separate aspect of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path to Enlightenment. The Buddha mentions five specific work activities that harm other beings and that one should avoid for this reason. First, dealing in weapons and arms. Second, dealing in living beings, including raising animals for slaughter, as well as the slave trade and prostitution. Third, working in meat production and butchery. Four, selling intoxicants such as alcohol and drugs. And five, dealing in poisons. So the Buddha also advised his followers to avoid deceitfulness, hypocrisy, high-pressure salesmanship, and trickery, or any kind of dishonest way of acquiring means of support. So when the Buddha talked about wealth, he always talked about wealth righteously gained. So these pieces of advice all applied to the Buddha's lay followers. But in the Buddha's time, monks and nuns did not engage in agricultural or other forms of work. However, when Buddhism went to China, this was not possible, as the Chinese people and culture expected monks to work. And so it became necessary for monks to work, to farm. And as Buddhist communities took on a definite shape and structure within the Chinese Chan Buddhist tradition, which later became Japanese Zen Buddhism, work became an essential part of monastic life. Bai Zhang, who is credited with creating the first true monastic structure for Chinese Chan monks, was well known for his saying, "A day without work is a day without eating." And in another well-known story, in the 13th century, Dogen, who was the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, traveled to China to study Buddhism. And whilst he was there, he met an old Tenzo. Tenzo means head cook at a Buddhist monastery. And this old Tenzo had walked 12 miles to buy some mushrooms brought over from Japan on Dogen's ship. And Dogen was puzzled by the distinguished old monk and asked him, "Venerable Tenzo, in your advanced years, why don't you wholeheartedly engage the way by doing Zazen?" Zazen is meditation. "Or studying the sutras, instead of troubling yourself by being Tenzo and just working. What is that good for?" And the Tenzo laughed loudly and said, "Oh, good friend from a foreign country, it is clear you have no idea what it means to wholeheartedly engage in the way. You have no idea because you don't understand the role of work." And this, I think, is echoed in Sangharakshita's phrase, more recent phrase, "If your work is not your meditation, then your meditation is not your meditation. If your work is not your meditation, then your meditation is not your meditation." More recently, again, E.F. Schumacher, in his essay, Buddhist Economics, lays out more fully what he thinks is the Buddhist attitude towards work. According to Buddhism, Schumacher says, work has three main purposes. The first is to give a person the opportunity to make the most of their potential. So work is there to give a person the opportunity to make the most of their potential. Secondly, it's there to help them to overcome their ego-centeredness by joining with other people in a common task. And thirdly, it's there to produce the goods and services needed for a becoming existence. And Schumacher goes on, to organize work in such a manner that it becomes meaningless, boring, stultifying, or nerve-wracking for the worker would be little short of criminal. It would indicate a greater concern with goods than with people, an evil lack of compassion, and a soul-destroying degree of attachment to the most primitive side of this worldly existence. Equally, to strive for leisure as an alternative to work would be considered a complete misunderstanding of one of the basic truths of human existence, namely that work and leisure are complementary parts of the same living process and cannot be separated without destroying the joy of work and the bliss of leisure. Schumacher's essay is a wonderful refutation of the approach to work of modern economics. Schumacher says there is a fundamental conflict between Buddhist economics and capitalist economics, since Buddhism sees the essence of civilization not in the multiplication of material wants, but in the purification of human character. And character, Schumacher believes, is formed primarily by a man's work. And this is echoed again in the last few years by Arthur Zajonc, who's the president of the Mind and Life Institute. And he says, through work as well as learning skills, we educate ourselves morally. He goes on, what we do shapes who we are as well as produces the goods and services needed for life. If we do something that is demeaning, soul-crushing, nerve-wracking, boring, then what we do gradually works its way inside us and debilitates and demoralizes us, diminishing our full capacity. If, on the other hand, we can find a way of working by fashioning convivial tools with which to work, then work can be ennobling, it can be nourishing, and the full capacity of our own humanity can unfold through that nourishment. So with the right technology, with the right tools, a productive connection between the inner and the outer can be forged. And the Buddha sensed this fully when he used so many similes and metaphors from the world of work when teaching techniques for the inner life of meditation and contemplation. Unfortunately, we live in a world where economics is narrowly obsessed with productivity. Increasing the amount of output delivered per person per hour, increasing productivity, is the holy grail of modern economic management. But ever-increasing productivity means that if our economies don't continue to expand, we risk putting more people out of work. If more is possible each passing year with each working hour, then either output has to increase or else there is less work to go around. Like it or not, it may appear that we are hooked on growth if we are to avoid less work being available. But what if we decide that the relentless pursuit of economic growth is destroying our planet and that we must seek a different economic strategy that limits growth? Is growing unemployment then inevitable? Not necessarily. One solution would be to accept the productivity increases, to shorten the work week, and to share the available work around. Now, these proposals have been around since the 1930s, since the Depression then, and are now enjoying something of a revival in the face of the continuing economic difficulties since 2008. There's an organisation here in Britain, the New Economics Foundation, a British think tank, who propose a 21-hour work week. Now, if you're a workaholic, this may not sound so attractive, but it's certainly a strategy worth thinking about. But economist Tim Jackson puts forward another strategy for keeping people in work when economic growth is either not available or is not desirable. And I think his proposal fits with Schumacher's idea of what a Buddhist approach to work involves. Remember, it's to give a person the opportunity to make the most of their potential, to help them to overcome their ego-centeredness by joining with other people in a common task, and to produce the goods and services needed for it becoming existent. What is his strategy? It is to let go of the relentless pursuit of productivity. It is to deliberately seek to increase employment in sectors of the economy and in jobs that are traditionally seen as low productivity sectors, such as the caring professions in medicine, in social work, in education, as well as the areas of crafts and of culture. Now, at first, Jackson recognises this may sound crazy because we've become so conditioned by the language of efficiency. But he says there are sectors of the economy, these sectors, where chasing productivity growth doesn't make any sense. Certain jobs and tasks rely on people giving their time and attention and care. And we can find these in medicine, social work and education, for example. Expanding jobs in these sectors and giving people more time to do their jobs directly improves the qualities of all our lives and the quality of their working lives. Making these professions more and more efficient is not desirable. Someone was telling me that because of the drive for efficiency and its associated form filling, teachers in the UK spend only 16 hours out of an average 48 hours working week actually teaching and learning with pupils. They only spend a third of their time actually in contact with pupils. So what sense does that make? Jackson is surely right to argue that instead of imposing meaningless productivity targets, we should be looking to improve the quality of care and the quality of experience of the caregiver. He says, "The care and concern of one human being for another is a peculiar commodity. It can't be stockpiled. It becomes degraded through trade. It isn't delivered by machines. Its quality rests entirely on the attention paid by one person to another." So he argues that care is not the only productivity, low productivity profession that might act as a source of economic employment. He points to crafts and to culture. With crafts, it is the accuracy and detail inherent in crafted goods that gives them lasting value. The time and attention paid by the carpenter or the seamstress or the tailor is what makes this detail possible. And the same is true of the cultural sector. It is the time spent, for example, practicing and rehearsing that gives performances their enduring appeal. Jackson rhetorically asks, "What would be gained by asking the New York Philharmonic to play Beethoven's Ninth Symphony faster and faster each year?" So, he believes that the modern tendency to view low productivity as a disease highlights the lunacy at the heart of a growth-obsessed, resource-intensive consumer economy. We end up, says Jackson, in a ridiculous situation where a whole set of activities that could provide meaningful work and contribute valuable services to the community are denigrated because they involve employing people to work with devotion, patience, and attention. Unfortunately, among economists, the tendency persists to spend their time using mathematically sophisticated calculations to check whether full employment pays or whether it might be more economic to run an economy at less than full employment so as to ensure lower price oil inflation, all in the pursuit of more output of goods and services. Schumacher reminds us that such a view is standing the truth on its head by considering goods as more important than people and consumption as more important than creative activity. Schumacher says, it's a surrender to the forces of evil. But the challenge of finding work that is both satisfying and provides an adequate income is a difficult proposition in our current economic system, particularly for those with family responsibilities. What can we do in these circumstances? What can we do to try and change attitudes to work? In the absence of the good fortune to be working at a job that is a vocation, that is emotionally rewarding and fulfilling, Sangha Rakshita suggests that for the individual Buddhist, in the context of an overall ethical approach to life, there are two particular aspects of the pursuit of right livelihood that we need to pay attention to. First of all, Sangha Rakshita gives advice on what kinds of jobs fit within an ethical approach. He talks about the kinds of jobs that need to be avoided. The first, he says, that need to be avoided are those like working in a slaughterhouse or in the manufacture of armaments that he says cannot be right for a Buddhist under any circumstances. The second type concerns those jobs that involve deliberately increasing people's greed, such as might be found in advertising or sales promotion. These need to be avoided by Buddhists. And fourthly, he says, the third type rather, he says, are those occupations that involve significant mental strain and tension such that meditation becomes difficult, if not impossible. And he says, if possible, these also should be avoided. So that's the first piece of advice. I'll come back to them in a minute. Second, Sangha Rakshita urges that those people whose job is simply a means to earning a living should restrict their working hours to the minimum required to earn enough to live off, so as to free up space to devote the time to Buddhist practice and to the spreading of the Dharma. Now, when we stand back and we consider Sangha Rakshita's suggestions, it does need to be remembered that he outlined this approach in a series of lectures given in Britain in 1968. At that time, unemployment was very low by current standards. I think it was about 300,000 or 400,000 people unemployed. Consequently, especially among young people, there was a very relaxed attitude to being in or out of work. You always knew you could find work. And in the late 1960s, moreover, there seemed to be the assurance of an increasing standard of living for the foreseeable future. They were good times. In present-day circumstances, there is much higher unemployment, with much greater insecurity amongst those in work. Longer working hours for many, a decreasing real value of wages and salaries, pressures to conform, pressure to take any job offered. All of these are much greater, those pressures, than they were in the 1960s. So because of this, I think, it can become a more difficult decision whether or not to take individual jobs or roles that might conflict ethically with Buddhist values, especially when others are dependent on the income that might be earned from the job. So I'm not saying people should do that, but I think we need to be very careful. We need to exercise compassionate judgment and care in those situations. We just shouldn't say to people, you can't do that job. You have to listen carefully to the conditions. Nevertheless, I do believe that Buddhists have a particular responsibility to try to exemplify the values of right livelihood in their individual working lives. At the very least, such issues need to be discussed amongst friends in Buddhist communities. But Buddhists can also respond collectively. We can respond collectively. Tim Jackson, as I have explained, writes about the three C's of care, craft, and culture. And earlier in the history of the Sri Ratna Buddhist community, there was a lot of talk about the three C's of centre, community, and cooperative. Later, cooperative changed into the rather more awkward expression, team-based right livelihood. And the idea behind team-based right livelihood is to provide a context in which Buddhists can work together in teams in businesses that exemplify right livelihood and that raise dana for Buddhist activities. And during our history in Tri Ratna, at various times there have been whole food shops, vegetarian cafes, printing shops, building firms, estate agents, gardeners, second-hand clothes shops, all employing Buddhists within team-based right livelihood businesses. Keeping these businesses going over the long term has proved difficult. A few still exist, and the principles of this approach operate in the teams that run retreat centres and in the bigger urban Buddhist centres. They are, in effect, team-based right livelihood businesses. And of course, until the beginning of this year, until very recently, the longest survivor and most well-known of team-based right livelihood businesses was, of course, Windhorse Evolution, which started as a market stall in London in the 1980s, became for a while one of the leading suppliers of giftware in the UK, with a central warehouse and a small chain of shops. But as we've recently heard, Windhorse Evolution is now closing down. The business was originally inspired by a vision to generate funds to be given to projects in the Tri Ratna Buddhist community, and the workers were doing this as a conscious practice of generosity. As time progressed, there was a growing awareness of the potential for work to be a place of individual and team-based spiritual practice. At its peak, hundreds of men and women from all backgrounds and many countries worked and contributed within the business. The warehouse, I don't know if you've been there, with its huge aisles and a stupa at its centre, was seen as a sacred ritual space. Team meetings explored spiritual practice or studied Buddhist texts. Sometimes work in the warehouse was carried out against the background of silent mornings focusing on mindfulness. And a great deal of money was raised for the development of activities in the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. Much of the infrastructure of our community has been raised through the activities of Windhorse Evolution. At the time of the demise of Windhorse Trading, it's important that we step back and evaluate what right livelihood means to us and to the world around us. It may seem idealistic, but I do believe we mustn't lose sight of what E.F. Schumacher wrote in Buddhist Economics about the purpose of work: to give a person the opportunity to make the most of their potential, to help them to overcome their ego-centeredness by joining with other people in a common task, and to produce the goods and services needed for a becoming existence. And we can consider, what can we do inside and outside the Tri Ratna community to promote right livelihood, to preserve a Buddhist vision of work? For many of us, this particularly concerns how do we earn our living in the modern world and provide sufficient income to live on for ourselves and our families. We need to give careful consideration to that. Can we help to revitalize Tri Ratna's three C's of center, community, and cooperative through Tim Jackson's three C's of care, craft, and culture? Can we rekindle a spirit of experimentation? One of the main emphases, Banti says, of our movement, experimentation. So I want those are things that you can consider and think about in the discussion groups this morning. But I want to conclude, as I did yesterday, with a poem by Robert Frost. And this is a poem about working as a farmer, cutting hay with a scythe. And when I was choosing this poem, I remembered Banti's aphorism: if your work is not your meditation, then your meditation is not your meditation. That was very much in my mind. And I think this poem points actually to something even more. In the right circumstances, work can lead to a state of dhyana, work can lead to a state of flow and concentration, of being thoroughly absorbed. And I think this poem captures something of that spirit. It's called Mowing. There was never a sound beside the wood but one, and that was my long scythe whispering to the ground. What was it, it whispered? I knew not well myself. Perhaps it was something about the heat of the sun, something perhaps about the lack of sound, and that was why it whispered and did not speak. It was no dream of the gift of idle hours or easy gold at the hand of fay or elf. Anything more than the truth would have seemed too weak to the earnest love that laid the swale in rows, not without feeble pointed spikes of flowers, pale orchises, and scared a bright green snake. The fact is, the sweetest dream that labour knows, my long scythe whispered and left the hay to make.